ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Genghis Khan apparently said, "It's easy to conquer the world from the back of a horse." And the founder of the Mongol Empire did just that. Horses and horsemanship continue to be central to Mongolian culture and identity. For Mongolians, horses have a deep spiritual significance, and it is a mark of a person's character how well they treat their horses. Winter in Mongolia is brutal. Temperatures can plummet to minus 50 degrees. And for centuries, there's been a tradition of small groups of herders bringing horses to fresh pastures. And it's a rite of passage for Mongolian nomads, one which demands phenomenal survival skills and incredible grit. A new Australian documentary called Iron Winter follows two young horse herders in their four-month journey with thousands of horses across the beautiful but unforgiving Mongolian steppes. It's directed by Casimir Burgess. Hi, Casimir.
Hi, Sarah.
How did you hear about this Mongolian tradition of the winter horse migration in the first place?
Yeah, look, it's a rather convoluted story, but I sold the camera to a young Adelaide producer and we got chatting and became kind of mates. And I said, "Oh, well, give me a buzz if, you know, you ever want to talk film and have a project you want to, you know, jam on." And 2 years later, he called me and he said, "My camera's been stolen," or "your camera's been stolen, the one you sold me. I've got a project, couple of thousand horses," he said. "Every year since time immemorial are taken by several young boys and they take them on a vast journey in search of pasture. And there's a community in Mongolia who are considering doing this again. It's been off for 6 years, but one family wants to bring it back." And yeah, I was immediately interested. And after looking at some of his incredible visuals that he'd taken on a trip there with journalist Edward Kavana, who wrote an article on the story, I was kind of hooked, and I asked if I could direct the film.
What was it that hooked you, Casimir?
Look, I think there was something mythic about this journey. There was something like a fable, but there was also some tension, some beautiful but difficult tension in these young boys who were deciding between the modern world and an ancient world, something that it seemed was kind of tearing them apart, because this tradition is under threat. Most young people are moving for the city. They see that as an easier life. But there was a couple of boys who wanted to keep the tradition alive, who wanted to do something that their forefathers had done for hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands of years.
So tell me about these two young men whose story your film focuses. You know, what were they like the first time you met them? What impression did you get?
Yeah, Buttfault was quiet and soulful and very watchful, bit younger than Sagana. So he was 19, Sagana was 21. Sagana was very expressive and had a bravado, you know, a big baseball hat and a swagger. And so Buttfault was kind of in his shadow a little bit, but it had you know, I could feel that his waters ran deep, if you will. So it felt to me instinctively, almost from the moment that I spoke to Buttfault, that he would be at the centre of the film.
Where physically did you first meet them, Casimir?
It was in a gur. Well, in fact, we waited for them in a gur, like an ancient sort of tent, a yurt. And, yeah, 10 hours of waiting, and they appeared on the horizon on horseback, and just side by side, almost in lockstep, and they rode towards us. It was quite a film-worthy entry.
Is waiting for 10 hours something that happens often when you're dealing with Mongolian culture?
I think so. They call it Mongolian time, and you just have to be patient. And, you know, "I'll see you tomorrow at midday" could mean the day after, or several days, and the distances are so vast. that, you know, there could be many good reasons that it takes that long, that those 10 hours, you know, they won't talk about it necessarily, and there's no apology. It's just that's what it is, different relationship to time and distance.
What did these young men's families think about your idea of filming them on this epic migration?
Yeah, there was a lot of enthusiasm. Our Mongolian producer, Enebesh Sangamanga, we call him Ene, he had, spoken to families before we arrived and worded them up about what we were hoping to do. And I guess it was important on our first visit there to gauge from the families, from the elders, from Ene, our producer, just how much need there was for this story, if there was a desire at all. We didn't want to impose anything.
Were they concerned at all about how some Australians might fare on the Mongolian steppe in wintertime?
Yeah, there was a lot of enthusiasm, yes, for it to happen, but they're like, how? You know, this is very hard for us, and we're inured to it. How will you manage when the temperature drops to minus 20 and 30 and 40 and 50? And will your noses fall off?
Will your noses fall off? Why is
that? Yeah. I guess they're more exposed. It was interesting. To pinpoint a body part, but it's true, you know, and we had to wear often special masks to protect our long pointy noses.
Well, when you went back in early 2024 to begin filming the migration itself, the boys were already off with the herd of horses. How did you go about finding them?
It was much harder than we'd imagined to find them. They were locatable on our GPS, on a little device we had with them, but they were so far away and there was this huge pass between us and them that we just couldn't make. And so we were stuck at a base camp that we'd set up, and each day we attempted this pass again in our 280 series Land Cruisers and a 1920s Russian missile carrier, which just dragged a huge tractor tire behind it to make a little semblance of road. Because we were so far from civilization, you know, the tiny town we'd come from was a good day's drive, and we just kept getting bogged, and we kept sliding back this mountain, which was very high. You know, the air was thin up there, and it was probably minus 40 that week. So we ended up, almost giving up, I guess. Each day we would come back to base camp with a great deal of despair. You really want to get to the herders, and each day you have there is so precious. So it felt as though we would never reach them, and it felt like a Lost in La Mancha or a, Fitzcarraldo or something. It was
a film about something not happening rather than something happening. How
exactly.
Did you manage to make it over that pass eventually?
There was a yak that kind of gave us solace at night. It felt like, you know, I was home with a pet. And that, I think, kept us a little grounded. But logistically, we managed to get the cars up and over the hill just by hand. So the whole team came together and just hand over hand, inch by inch, until we managed those really steep parts. It was the only thing left to try, and it worked, thankfully.
Once you managed to meet up with these young herders, how had the migration been going? What sort of mood were they in?
At that point, they were still in high spirits. The toll of winter, hadn't taken its toll. It was new, and they were excited. And the two elders were with them, Zizere and Beinhanger. Beinhanger is Butfault's father, and Zizere is the uncle. And they were very supportive. So, yeah, it was like the start of winter, and still cold and brutal, but they hadn't experienced losses yet.
What did the landscape look like, Casimir?
It's very beautiful, incredibly stark, treeless, almost lunar landscape, very bright often with that blue, piercingly blue, famously blue Mongolian sky. And, yeah, it takes your breath away. As Ben said, it's hard to get a dud. Our cinematographer, Ben Bryan, hard to get a dud frame out here. It just opens up to eternity, and it frees your soul somewhat. So you feel invigorated and inspired, but also intimidated.
When they're out there on the steppe with the herd of horses, where do the men sleep?
They have a tiny little gur, which is maybe 2 meters in diameter, and they sort of just hold each other tight in that space, literally clinging on to life.
So it's something that they bring with them, that they kind of construct as they move with the horses? How does it work?
Yeah, look, the gur they had was, I was told, 400 years old and just handed down and down and down from their forefathers. And you could see all the beautiful little scars and their little bits of, you know, ancient graffiti in the cross sections, beautiful wooden made light timber that they could pack onto their horses. And it would take probably an hour to set up. And there would be a little fireplace that would also go on the back of the horse with a chimney. And that was vital to keep them warm and to not freeze alive.
Well, I mean, given the extraordinary temperatures, are they warm inside that little shelter?
Yeah, they can get incredibly warm. So it was one thing that I struggled with, was coming from minus 50 to plus 30 in that space. And trying to film in that space was really tricky for Ben Bryan and I, and sometimes the sound recordist. Mm.
Give me more of a sense of their day-to-day life when they're out there with the horses. What do they eat? Where do they go to the bathroom? How do you live in somewhere as extreme as that?
Yeah, well, I guess it's, as my son calls it, a bush wee.
There's no bush.
That's
it's a
right.
Step wee.
Well, there's no step wee. There's nowhere to hide. So you know, whenever we needed to go to the toilet, you're on full display. I guess their routine is, you know, you muster the horses, you bring them together. At the start of winter, they're much more spread out. And as it gets colder and colder, the horses, you know, come tighter and tighter together until they're in a sort of perfect mandala, a circle from above, and that's for their protection. The herders will sort of initiate that and bring them together, but it felt like eventually the horses were naturally forming in that pattern so that the collective warmth will keep them alive. And the boys will take it in turns. They'll watch all night long and shoot wolves as they come, alone or in packs. And, yeah, walk amongst the horses and soothe them if they need to, sing to them. The herders will have a big breakfast, oats and some things that they carry in, sort of staples that they carry on the back of the horse. Oftentimes they're breaking the horses in too, because the horses are, many of them are wild. They've collected all of the community's horses. It's a kind of community service in a way, but it's a job. They're farmers and they're trying to earn a living. But, yeah, the horses come together and they watch over them, and then they go out and search for pasture, and the horses will find pasture or they won't. And sometimes, yeah, as winter progresses, as we observed, it got really hard to penetrate the hard ice, and the horses really struggled.
For you as a filmmaker, Casimir, you and the crew, what was your daily life like while you were on location?
We were at base camp for some time, and it was necessary to send dead batteries and cards for media back to that base camp where there was a generator and things like this. And so those things would be delivered to us every couple of days. So we were with the herders, even, you know, much more remote than base camp, maybe another day on from base camp, and base camp was already felt like the end of the world. So, yeah, if a storm came, though, and the weather was bad or there was a breakdown of one of the cars, we went without cards or batteries and sometimes food as well. And the herders observed this, and they started giving us some of their food if they had enough. And as horses began to die, actually, we ate horse meat, which was incredibly confronting, and our bodies really didn't agree with it. But, you know, it kept everyone alive. And it certainly wasn't as though they were killing horses to eat them. It was just, this is possible sustenance from an animal that has died.
A lot of the the filming is very intimate scenes, you know, the two friends talking together inside the Gur or standing next to one another out on the step. How did you do that so it wasn't intrusive, or how did you encourage that feeling of real sort of ease and intimacy that are there between the two boys in this film?
They just didn't seem to be self-conscious, and I think it felt like a lot of Mongolians we met were just so centred and sort of they knew themselves in some way. Yeah, even the boys, in a way, they had a confidence, and the camera didn't throw them. But also, I think just spending so many days and so many hundreds of hours with them, they just get used to you, and that was important. But we would start the day in a little huddle, you know, nose to nose, forehead to forehead. It was quite intimate. And they, although we weren't speaking the same language, we learnt to speak often without words and with gestures and smiles and cheeky twinkling eyes. You know, there was a lot of communication that it felt as though we were talking.
Well, I wanted to ask you about language because given that you don't speak Mongolian, how did you know when you were recording whether they were saying something significant or what was happening in terms of the story development between those characters?
Well, the honest truth is often we didn't know what they were saying. Oftentimes we would have a translator there and they were, you know, in my ear. NA would be like, this is great. You know, he might not even give me any any details on it, but he's just like, just make sure you've pressed record on this one. I guess it was just a sense of gravitas that they would bring that you could hear, you learnt to read. But, yeah, also NA translating or Eric translating, they were giving you little synopsis like, yeah, this is about, you know, the spirits in the sky, or this is about the need to crack a goat's jaw to allow for its spirit to reincarnate, you know, little things like this that, you know, and then you get back into the edit and the things you thought were most profound are not. They're just, you know, making fun of, you know, my haircut that particular day, or maybe but the opposite was true as well. Sometimes something would just be said in such a poetic, beautiful way, and they speak often in a way that's epic and mythic, just hits the spot like a little haiku. And I use many of those moments.
There's a lot of talk about rebirth in Iron Winter, about the horse's rebirth or human rebirth. It does seem to be a culture which is really infused with a kind of reverence and spirituality.
Yeah, it's interesting how they just seem to take the best bits of many religions or belief systems, you know, whether it's shamanic or Buddhist or Christian. But, yeah, that the boys did seem to have a real fascination with what happens after we die, which is great that they're so young. I don't know if I was tackling those big existential issues at that age myself.
You weren't herding horses across minus 50 in a frozen step either, Casimir.
But yeah, true. Maybe I think it forces them to reflect on some of those bigger themes and their place within a circle of life and death, because they're so close to life and to death every day.
Tell me about the horses that they're herding. They're giving them lots of haircuts in the film too. What's that about?
Oh, look, I think it's one of the ways that they bond with the horse, but they just take such incredible pride in the horse and the horse's appearance and their own as well. You know, there was always time, you know, for Sagana to, he carried a comb in his top pocket and, you know, underneath that baseball hat, you know, he had immaculate combed hair, even at, you know, in the most ridiculous storm and at minus 50, very well presented. And the horses too, they just looked after. They had great sort of pride in their herd, which they were tasked by their community to protect over 5 months. And so they would ride them. They had their favourites, and they would ride them like a bat out of hell.
As the winter progressed, what kind of conditions were you and these young men and their horses facing?
Yeah, we didn't realise at the time, but it was Mongolia's harshest winter on record, with 7.4 million deaths of cattle you know, horses and sheep and cows, yaks, etc., and many herders displaced. We were so remote, and we didn't have our finger on the news at all. But it makes sense when you look at what our herders were dealing with on a day-to-day basis. A horse died nearly every day because of the wild swings in weather, from hot to cold. Well, when I say hot, it's like minus 10, let's say, but then minus 50s. You would have the snow melting and then hardening, melting a little bit, then hardening. And that would create a very hard ice that the horses couldn't penetrate. And so they would spend too much energy trying to get through to that bit of pasture and often keel over or eventually starve. And cold and things like that, the wind chill, that they could usually maybe with the right level of fodder survive, it just made them very vulnerable.
How did the young men feel about you filming that part of their journey when horses were dying from the cold and starvation?
They wanted us to keep filming, but there were several moments, particularly with Sagana, where he just wanted audio. You know, I think there was a feeling of shame, or, you know, they had some... Sagana, I know, felt a responsibility to look after these horses and felt like he'd let them down. Of course, there's nothing that he could have really done to change the circumstance. But, he went into himself for sure. And Buttvolt was, I don't know, he was a bit sort of out of his depth in some ways too. It just hit home and maybe confirmed to him in some ways that perhaps this tradition might be on its last legs, mm-hmm. and that maybe the city was maybe a more attractive option.
For you, Casimir, what was it like to be out there when those storms hit and that temperature was plummeting in that way? What was it like?
Oh, yeah, it does break you down a little bit. And, you know, I was obviously excited to capture the initiation of these boys in this ancient pathway to manhood tradition, but I didn't expect it to be as much an initiation for myself and the crew. We went in pretty naive. If I'm honest, we sort of just loved the world and the story, and there was something, you know, big and romantic about it. But so we just sort of maybe didn't prepare as much as we should. So, look, I was devastated as horses started to die and quite emotional, because you get to know them. They're part of the family. You know, you might not remember every face of those thousands of horses, but you do. It's like, oh, that's the one that Sagana was riding just a couple of days ago. And so, yeah, it made me homesick at times at the worst moments, at the coldest moments, or the moments of grief, and we're also sort of, I don't know, we were all grief sponges for each other, the crew and the herders, and it was just about surviving and being pragmatic as you could about it, just to get through.
When those really heavy, huge storms would hit, what did it sound like?
Zud, as they call it, D-Z-U-D, means great destroyer, and it kind of just sounds like a wrecking ball of just white noise. You can't think, you can't see. Maybe you could see your hand in front of you, but you'll see some images in the storm, in the film, where the camera's sort of shaking and we're looking through the horse legs to the girl. And I was holding Ben, our cinematographer, just so he could get the shot. But we were fully locked into each other, but just being hurtled and thrown around. And the shot's only 10 seconds, maybe 5 or 10 seconds, but it felt like an eternity. I couldn't feel my hands for several days after that.
Have Buttvolt and Sagana seen the finished film?
Yeah, it screened in their local town. Ben Colotta, the initiating producer, actually went back there with Edward Cavanna, the writer of that Al Jazeera article. And I think that would have been a beautiful full circle moment. They said that the town just embraced the film, and there was talk of even having it on permanent display in the town hall there so that, you know, people, maybe if they can't do a winter herd, maybe they can at least come and see what they've done, what they're capable of. Have incredible pride for what those herders do over those long winter months and how they survive. And the horses are their totems and their gods, you know. So the herders are like heroes over there. And someone from our Australian team will talk to the boys nearly every day, and they continue to send photos. They seem to know if the film's at a festival or it's won an award or in whatever country, that they seem to know before we do. And they're incredibly proud and will send photos of flowers or Sagana just kissing his girlfriend or just random sort of pics and emojis, which is really affirming that we're still friends. It feels like we have a friendship for life.
What about your own growing up, Casimir? How did your growing up compare to life on the Mongolian steppes?
Oh, it just can't. I had a very idyllic...
warmer, wherever it privileged. Was, it must have been warmer.
Yeah, it was. Look, we were in Richmond at a pretty interesting time when it was really multicultural and colourful and lots of factories and and there was a heroin issue as well. So, you know, of a morning I would actually go out and collect syringes in a little basket and make sure, you know, we didn't step on them when we played handball or marbles or something later.
What had drawn your mum and dad to that part of Melbourne, to Richmond?
My mum, Pip Stokes, and my father, Greg Burgess, they just found a house they liked, and I think it was, you know, property was actually affordable back then, and they just built a home somewhere they could afford, and they wanted to be central, and they liked the hustle and bustle of the city and the trams and all the action in all of its various colours. Dad, an architect, well, he played football before that, and Mum was a painter and a sculptor and a poet.
You've got a twin sister, Casimir. Where did your parents take the two of you many weekends when you were growing up?
There was a little shack that Mum and Dad had acquired in the 70s, and it was in the Grampians, well, the Black Range, which is sort of just opposite the Grampians, about 10 minutes out of Stawell. Yeah, it's beautiful, powerful country. And there was a hut there, granite, built by a woman named Mary and her daughter in about 1890. And very basic, you know, earthen floor, tank water. Mum and Dad got some power connected, but it was very sporadic. So, yeah, you had that contrast there. You'd go and pick mushrooms, and in the city you'd be picking up syringes. So it was a really nice balance, actually, and certainly a place where I fell in love with nature and probably found one of the main themes running through my work.
Your mum grew up in Western Australia. Tell me about her dad and his love of adventure.
Yeah, I guess, yeah, if you were to try to trace, you know, some of the adventuring impulses that I have, you might look to my grandfather, and he would always tell us stories of salvaging old shipwrecks and looking for artefacts, like on the Zuiddorp, a Dutch wreck off the coast of WA, and of free diving. And
he was
getting
free diving?
Yeah, it was just one of his hobbies, but he actually held the Southern Hemisphere record for free diving in the 50s. And he wore the prize, which was, I think it was an Omega watch, proudly for the rest of his life. But yeah, I mean, his house was filled with artifacts that I think it was a little bit like, you know, one for the museum, one for him, maybe.
What kind of things do you remember seeing in his
I'm
place?
I'm probably exaggerating, but there were definitely cannonballs, which
that
is pretty wild.
That he collected from shipwrecks?
Yeah.
What else?
There was some coins, like silver coins. There were old daggers. Just all the things, you know, a young boy wants to see and hold, you know, those things that you can't quite get to in the museum. I would just take one home for the night.
Did he introduce you to freediving as well, Casimir?
My uncle Jono and my grandfather John Senior, they were both, yeah, incredibly comfortable in the water. And I think, yeah, whether it was Uncle John or my grandfather, they certainly, both of them at different times, would give me techniques for swimming and for diving and holding my breath. And I would practice at both of their pools, just breath holding. You know, you start at 1 minute, 2 minutes, 3 minutes, until you're at 4 minutes later on in life.
That can be very dangerous, can't it? I mean, were your parents concerned, or did it ever feel risky to you?
Yeah, look, I feel like, you know, when I'm talking to Arlo, my 7-year-old son, and Lottie, who's 10, we're much more aware now, I think, of shallow water blackouts and of the risks of basically biting off more than you can chew, of having a, what would you call it, like a mental strength that pushes through what your body's actually capable of. That's really dangerous. You know, maybe it's helpful if you want to get to the top of Everest or, you know, survive a Mongolian winter. But I think, I was possibly a bit silly in how far I pushed that, because I did feel close to passing out several times.
Your grandma Audrey, your mum's mum, had left the family home when your mum was a child. What was her story?
Yeah, Audrey was a beautiful, sensitive soul who developed schizophrenia, which, you know, was really tough, I think, particularly in the 50s, any time, right? It's going to be tough. But in the 50s, you know, with so much stigma around mental health, and just push that under the carpet, she was institutionalized. My grandfather, John, put her in an asylum. And, you know, as a single father, you're not meant in that era, not supposed to have kids by yourself. It was just unheard of. So he also put the kids in an orphanage.
This was your mum and her siblings?
Yeah, my mum and her brother, Jono. And Jane, my auntie, I think she was just old enough to go with the grandparents. But the other two, you know, the idea was just for my mum, Pip, and John not to be a burden on anything, just put them in the orphanage. It was a tough time, but it was short-lived. They ran away from that orphanage. They ran away, you know, from somewhere around Cottesloe, but they made it almost all the way to Fremantle. And there's a few different stories on this, but I think they slept on the beach. But yeah, they were found shortly after, and thankfully my grandfather, he took them back in. Yeah, to his credit, he became what my Auntie Jane calls a really actually outstanding father, and a rare example of a 50s dad who took responsibility for his kids in that way as a solo caregiver. But yeah, Audrey was in the institution and undergoing electric shock therapy, and I think she just had a suitcase at the end of her bed just waiting and hoping that her family would come back.
Did you ever get to meet her, Casimir?
Yeah, many times, you know, and with, you know, in the 70s and 80s things, actually, there was a lot more insight into mental health, and her medication, you know, started to help things. And, yeah, we would go over to WA from Melbourne and visit her. And I just remember these big kind of open spaces with lots of beds and that suitcase still at the end of her bed as she was waiting for granddad, for her husband to come and pick her up still. And yet she found peace, and she walked through the gardens and spoke to fairies, and just very connected to nature. Yeah, and John, my uncle, visited her very regularly, and they became very, very close, particularly in the later years.
As you say, it was a very common sort of advised thing that doctors would advise families to put a member who had significant mental illness into an asylum. How did your granddad feel about it all, you know, especially as he got older?
Yeah, look, from the day he left her there, he never saw her again in his entire life. And when she died, I guess he was probably 70 years old or so, he I'm told that he cried and cried and was not a particularly maybe emotionally open or vulnerable person. This was quite a big deal, and I'm sure there was regret and so many layers of unresolved feelings he had around it, but he did say she was, you know, one of his big loves.
He never went in and saw her again. Does that mean your mum didn't see her as she was growing up?
No, mum did. You know, mum went against the grain, and she just kept seeing her mum, going to visit her. She adored her. And Jono and Jane, likewise.
After your grandma was put in the asylum and your mum and her siblings were living just with their dad, your mum got seriously ill herself. What happened?
Yeah, she developed leukemia and got incredibly ill. This was in a time, I think, when people didn't survive from that, particularly children. So, yeah, my grandfather got a job in Kalangadu in a sawmill. He was working there and took the family, but mum was placed in this hospital in Adelaide, and she would get visits from the family every so often, but she also spent incredible amount of time by herself there, just getting sicker and sicker, which would have been, you know, obviously pretty tough for a little one.
Mm. How did she spend her time there, you know, all that time alone in isolation? Mm.
She would, she taught herself to draw and to paint, and as she explained to me, she felt that there was something about that, paying attention to nature, to plants, to the sunrise, you know, all the things she could see out of the window from her hospital bed, that she found healing in that. And there was someone else who was painting in the garden that she described, and I think she may have befriended this person, and that they maybe taught her or gave her some pastels or, yeah, some ingredients that she could keep furthering her art with. Mm. But, yeah, I think that for mum it was the hardest, one of the hardest things she ever lived through, having a priest come, you know, to her deathbed, which it was at the time she was told she was going to die, and read her last rites, give her a splash of holy water and a piece of cloth from a saint, which she kept, you know, for the rest of her life. But she was so stubborn and resilient in a way that she wasn't going to let this little terminal illness kill her. So she somehow she survived, and yeah, as I mentioned, she always saw it as the art that healed her, and the attention she gave to nature. She just wanted to keep painting. She wanted to live, to keep, you know, observing the world.
You've also yourself had some very close calls. Tell me about the football injury that you got as a teenager.
Yeah, well, I don't know, I always wanted to play football. I was rubbish. But, you know, Dad played for Hawthorn, so there was a certain, and he never put any pressure on me to play football. But it was just a game of kick to kick at lunchtime on the oval, and I went up for a mark and caught it, landed on my back, and another kid, I would have been 16 years old, 17 years old, he landed with his bony knee on my spleen, and it exploded the organ. Oh. Not that I knew it at that time. I just kind of hobbled off the oval and went to the bathroom and looked at my face and realised I was a very strange kind of bluey, grey, yellow. And then I got very cold and went and laid on a heater, turned the heater on. It was summer, so that was concerning. I was just shaking from the cold.
Once you were taken to hospital, Casimir, did they know right away that your spleen had been ruptured?
No, they actually thought that I just had deep internal bruising. But there was this doctor, a Chinese man, who came up and he started doing some acupressure, like some pressure point work. And this ended up saving my life because he, as he said, if this boy is not in surgery in the next couple of hours, he'll bleed out. I was internally bleeding and lost quite a few litres of blood. But they cut me open and the scar's about a foot long, and these days it would be, you know, keyhole. But maybe that was the urgency of needing to get it out. Whatever it was, I've got a ridiculous scar now and no spleen.
No spleen. And are there long-term health effects of losing your spleen, of not having a spleen?
Yeah, it's actually, it seems like there's more and more research to show that the spleen is a pretty important part of your immune system. Not having it has... It makes me more susceptible to colds and viruses and bacteria.
Well, that became a point of issue years later when you were 27. By that stage, you know, you'd finished school, you'd gone to art school and had started working in film. And then you were doing some filming outside of the National Gallery of Victoria. What decision did you make that day?
Yeah, because... we'd actually had the pond emptied so that our actor, Kim Ginjal, brilliant comedic actor, you might remember from Fast Forward and Full Frontal. I was making this short, co-directing this short trailer, I think it was, for Raindance Film Festival in the UK. And it required for the actor, for Kim's character, to go underwater and find coins because he was hustling to buy his next independent filmmaker, just trying to earn enough money or steal enough money from the bottom of the NGV pond wishing thing to buy another canister of film. But Kim was like, I'm not putting my head under there. And I said, no, it's all good. We've actually had the water changed over. And he said, nah, look at all the algae. And yeah, so very clever man. But of course, me being me and a bit silly and knowing also that perhaps I could hold my breath for long enough to get the take, maybe even longer, I'll, you know, just show off a little bit. I went under and some of the water from that pond went up into my nasal cavity, as water does, you know, when you're swimming and holding your breath for a couple of minutes. We got the shot, but I got quite sick about a week later. And I should say it's speculative that it was the NGV wishing pond because they can't really trace meningitis. You know, I was also at the time swimming at the swimming pool every day and doing laps underwater there. So
meningitis can be extremely serious. How quickly did you realise that's what you had or what was involved in treating that?
I was just violently vomiting and became very sensitive to light. Very sort of sore, stiff neck, just classic symptoms. I spent a couple of days in hospital and then came home and slowly recovered. And within a couple of weeks, I was like, oh, you know what? Maybe I can go back to the pool. So I tried it out and it was horrendous. Like I realized that I would possibly be living with the after effects of viral meningitis for some time.
What do you mean? What way was it horrendous?
It felt like a relapse, like the neck became very stiff again, the light sensitivity. It became apparent that as with long COVID or some post-viral complications that you can't just return to your normal way of being. I couldn't swim every day anymore. I had to take a year off and basically spent a year in bed. And realised probably after about that year that that wasn't helping. So just return to regular life, but at half capacity. Actually, at that time, I was probably slurring a little bit. I didn't have nearly as much energy. I lost a lot of muscle mass, kind of like I think of it as an acquired brain injury. And I know people have some horrendous brain injuries, so not to underestimate that experience, but I certainly spoke differently and lived differently after that. And maybe one of the hardest moments was when one of my friends said, "Yeah, you know what, you used to be on fire and actually quite funny." So the thought of being changed at those sort of fundamental levels was difficult. I mean, I was never that funny to start with, so the fact that I was less funny now was deeply concerning.
You should have said to him, "You used to be nice, you know, you used to be empathetic." Has that changed in the years since, Casimir, or is that an ongoing reality that the sort of shifts in your energy and your way of thinking following that infection?
It's ongoing for sure. Yeah, there will be a relapse for me at least once a year. But now I know have a little rest. Don't stay in bed for weeks and months at a time. But just listen to your body and try not to get too stressed, and also try not to get too hot, because humidity seems to inflame whatever's going on in my head, whether it's scar tissue around the meninges. The meninges is the outer lining of the brain. And yeah, it's the lumbar puncture or the spinal tap that reveals that you have meningitis or not. And yeah, that was a nightmare. So I've certainly never wanted to have another one of those again.
Well, I mean, that's where I have to ask the decision to go and make a movie in the incredibly demanding conditions of a Mongolian winter. What did that mean for your health, or how did your body, your mind cope with that?
You know what? Surprisingly well. The heat and humidity is a big problem for me, but Mongolia was a treat. You know, I was thinking actually quite clearly, aside from, you know, it being painful at times for your body, my mind, for those moments that you can go out into minus 50 for 20 minutes of filming, that you've got to retreat. But for those times, I actually felt really invigorated. You know, maybe it's a kind of a Wim Hof, you know, philosophy of, you know, helping with inflammation, the cold actually being your friend in that way. So, look, I've been doing cold showers and some sort of deep breathing and circular breathing and things like this to help me. So I think the cold is my friend, and perhaps, yeah, it was the perfect film for me to get involved with.
Not long after that period of you being really unwell, your mum was diagnosed with cancer again. For someone who'd gone through, you know, being given the last rites as a little girl, was she prepared for death, do you think? Was it a presence for her differently because of what she'd gone through as a girl?
Yeah, look, I think she'd spent her whole life making work about death and about life, but about the cycles in nature and about that liminal space between life and death. She just knew it. She'd walked there. And I feel like, yeah, she didn't need to talk about her own terminal illness or what plans needed to be made or, you know, to be totally expressive about what she was going through with her second ended up being deadly cancer. She kind of just lived it. So, yeah, there's a part of me that regrets not being able to talk with her so openly about her imminent death the second time around. But also, yeah, maybe because she'd come so close to it, it was just implicit to her, and she lived such a graceful, yeah, dignified but searching life. She was an artist who just every day was a bonus from that time that she was read her last rites as a small girl. So I feel like she had no regrets in a lot of ways. Of course, she wanted to keep living and see us grow more, my sister and I and Greg, you know, the love of her life. They were, yeah, just incredible to observe together, and the way they made art together. They just had such a big, inspiring life. So although she was only 60, I feel like she lived several lifetimes.
You must have been thinking about her, or she must have been in your thoughts and in your heart while you were making this extraordinary film on the other side of the world.
Yeah, particularly particularly when we were, in that first week trying to get up and over the pass and reach our herders. That yak that became our friend and would sleep outside of our door every night just for that little bit of warmth that it wanted, it needed. It got sicker and sicker, and I remember just being in its arms, which is a bizarre image, but like I said, it became like a pet. And it was its breathing pattern reminded me a lot of Mum's when she was when she was dying in the last hour of her life. So that at that moment it really hit home, just missed Mum so much. But also felt connected to her strangely. Through that bloody huge yak. as we all have loved ones who have crossed over that threshold, who have died, and I feel like they're there still. You know, I talk to Mum still within myself if I have problems, and it feels as though she can answer. I feel beautifully haunted by her ever since.
Casimir, it's been really wonderful to speak with you. Thank you so much for being my guest on Conversations.
Thank you, Sarah. Pleasure.
Casimir Burgess's film is called Iron Winter, and we'll put a link to it at the Conversations website. This story was produced by Jen Leake and recorded on the lands of the Yagara and Turrbal peoples. Our executive producer is Eliza Kirsch. I'm Sarah Kanoski. Thanks for listening.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.